from WCPB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 Podcast. Today's guest, Bob Quinn, Norwood's own. He's the former general manager of the Detroit Lions and a longtime NFL executive. He started his career in 2000 with the Patriots, was with the team through the 2015 season, had a variety of roles working for Bill Belichick. He was a pro scout, he was a regional scout, he was a national college scout, he was assistant director of pro personnel and director of pro scouting before he left. He takes us inside an NFL draft room and an NFL war room and what it's like as these teams have to make these decisions. Also, Bob talks about the best fits for the Patriots in this draft at quarterback. A lot of intrigue surrounding the team in terms of trying to find their quarterback of the future in this draft. Also, we'll talk about why teams are having a harder time this year evaluating players during the pandemic draft than they have in the past. And Ellen asked a really cogent question of Bob, and that's the role that social media plays now in this generation of players and in scouting.
Yeah, of course, my first thing whenever we have a guest is I try to creep their social media and get a feel of who they are, what they're like, what they like. And I couldn't find his social media. So I have a feeling he has like a fake Instagram or a fake Twitter out there because there's no way he's not like looking into players or even spying on his own kids. And so I asked him about what the role of social media plays when it comes to drafting these players. And I was surprised to hear that it plays a big role.
It does, and I was also surprised to hear that it dates back 6 or 7 years. So we're going to want to hear Bob on that. But my thought the whole time, Ellen, was because he mentioned that he had people who had done this for him, for the Lions, and that actually he got a pitch from a company that was doing this. And I was like, Ellen will do this for you for free. She loves creeping on people on social media. And this is like what you've done. You do it. You said you've done in the past for dates. You do it for coworkers. This is like something you just like to do in your spare time.
I just feel like if you can get a feel of someone before you meet them, it's very helpful. I do it always before interviews, like a job interview. You got to find out like what that person's all about. And I wouldn't say I would do it for free because I know like he has some money to spend, but like I would do it at definitely a reduced cost.
Well, you are the type of person, you know, based on your, I'd say, social media acumen, which I don't have, that NFL teams should be looking to employ. You know how like the government is like, oh man, we're being hacked, so we're gonna take like all these crazy hacker kids.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Like they should take you because the way you can get on social media and decipher what's going on with like a Kardashian or what's up with somebody from The Bachelor or The Bachelorette franchise.
Even just like athletes.
I know.
And like who they're hanging out with.
See?
Yeah.
You're really good. So they should go to you.
They really should come to me, and this is, I guess, my pitch for that.
Yeah, totally. So here's what I want to know, though. Did you scrub your own social media before you got hired at Channel 5 the way you scrubbed the nose ring you once had and now have again?
So I have been scrubbing my social media probably since I graduated college. But just like the nose ring, I'm still on social media talking about Bravo, dumb things. So, I mean, it's only going to come back at some point.
Yeah, at some point, you know, it's going to come back to haunt you. But obviously, you were a good enough prospect that Channel 5 wanted to bring you on. And so that's sort of the lesson here when it comes to scouting. NFL teams, they will leave no stone unturned because the reality is this is a lot like a job interview process for them. We look at it and say it's sports and it's fun and games. For these teams, it's all business because they are investing a lot of time, money, effort, and their hopes into these prospects. So Bob Quinn gives us the lowdown on the NFL draft and how teams prepare for it. He's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, now, as promised, we're joined by longtime NFL front office executive and scout Bob Quinn. Bob worked for the Patriots from 2000 to 2015. He has a tremendous background in player personnel. When he left the Patriots, he was the director of pro scouting for the team when he went to the Detroit Lions to become general manager. But also, he spent a good amount of time of his career as a college scout for the Patriots, and he was the team's national scout as well. So nobody better to talk about the NFL draft with. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, thank you for joining us here. We're going to jump right in, Bob. I want to know, What is your general philosophy on the draft as someone who has been in the circumstance of having to make these decisions when it comes to best player on the board versus the need of your team?
Yeah, I always go with the, it's got to be a blend of both need and best available, depending on the position, obviously. You got to look at the board, and you, what you never want to do is overreach for need. You know, overreach, you know, it's different definitions, but it could be, you know, half a round. You never want to overreach by that much. You know, going into each draft, you obviously have holes on your roster that you need to fill too. So you have to kind of take all of that into account and look at it. And then you look at the depth of the draft and, well, if I can't get, you know, position X in the first round, is there depth in rounds 2 and 3, knowing that the player is going to be a little lesser, but they're still graded high enough that you'd feel comfortable taking them in the second or third round. And that's where the calculation of taking a guy a little bit higher and risking the guy, his, you know, position mate not being there, you know, 40 picks later. So it's always a blend, and it's always kind of what you discuss the most in the draft room is, all right, this guy's by far the best player, but we have, you know, two good players at the position. Which way do you want to go?
That's really interesting. And take me into the draft room a little bit, because I know there's so much prep that goes into it for the teams. And I don't even know if a lot of fans realize this. Obviously, you do from your time as a regional college scout and also national scout. But there's entire scouting apparatus for organizations that spend all year working on this. And then, you know, you get to the offseason and it becomes a little bit more collaborative, obviously, with other members of the front office and the coaching staff. But when you're in that draft room, you've gone over so many scenarios. How many decisions are sort of made, I don't want to say spur of the moment, but in real time, and how many of them are sort of predetermined where you've gone through exercise and you say, if this happens, we're going to do this. We've talked about it. We knew this guy would be here and we're going to take him, or we knew these three guys would be here and our decision was to do this.
I would say the great majority happen, decisions are made prior to the draft. That's, you know, the week leading up to the draft, maybe about 6-7 days out, you kind of finalize your board. And then, you know, the week of the draft, the week we're in now, you're talking to other teams, you're talking about trade possibilities. You kind of do an internal mock draft that you bring your staff in, or you bring 6 or 7, 8 guys in the room, and you kind of go, you know, do it a couple times over the course of a couple days to see who might land, you know, to you in the first round. Now, I think, you know, once you get into the 30s and 40s, it's really hard to predict, you know, what may or may not be there. So you really have to follow the board and just trust that the way you stacked it the week before, and in the conversations you had, because there's always clusters on the draft board. There's clusters of 2 or 3 guys, 3 or 4 guys. And so that's kind of what you do a lot of in April. You kind of, you know, bring your staff together, or you bring your coaches in, and you watch them together if you can, and kind of, you know, break the ties of those players that are in clusters on the draft board by each position.
Do you ever get in a scenario, and have you ever been this scout, or have you ever had to deal with a scout where there's somebody who's just so impassioned for a player that they're making that last minute appeal to say, I know we said we were going to do this, but I'm telling you, we got to take player X.
Not really. Cause I think, you know, my years in New England, you know, it was, you know, all those things were hashed out prior to, everyone had plenty of opinions, time to give their opinions, whether it's, you know, December meetings, February meetings, April. So really not. And then, you know, when I went to Detroit, obviously I instilled a similar type scouting system, and we kind of had the same set of meetings that, you know, we would have when I was in New England. So none of those too much. I think, you know, it's obviously guys, you know, there's certain people that are going to speak up in the draft room and certain people that aren't, just by personality and by, you know, where you kind of rank in the hierarchy of the department. I think although, you know, I've been in whatever 21 draft rooms over the years since 2000 at various levels, and there hasn't really been any arguments in the ones that I've been in. So I guess I'm fortunate for that.
Well, that explains, I mean, you've obviously, you know, been in organizations that have had success. So, I mean, that sort of speaks to it. Just sticking with sort of that draft room theme, in your experience, I don't want to say what's the right number of people in the draft room, but is there sort of an idea of, you know, how many people you need or want in that draft room? And can it become a situation where sometimes maybe there's too many guys in there, or there's not enough, you know, I want to check with this one scout who I know was responsible for this region. I have his report in front of me, but he's not in the room, and I want to look in his eye, like right here, right now.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the best way to answer it is it depends on how big your room is.
Okay.
like, some offices and some setups have, you know, enormous rooms that they use for the draft room, and some organizations don't. Our draft room in New England was a little bit on the smaller side, and we had a few lesser people. Fortunately for our draft room in Detroit, my first draft room, we actually put in a new one my second year, which I was fortunate enough to make it a lot bigger. So there was more space, and we included probably more people. You know, you always want to, you know, have everyone involved, because the scouts that are on the road, you know, they're the lifeline of the organization. They're on the road, you know, staying in hotels 200 nights a year. So that's their Super Bowl when the draft comes along. So my opinion was always to, you know, have those guys in the room, and you always, you know, look back and you kind of, you give them, hey, this is the guy we're taking, everybody good. And they, you know, everyone kind of shakes in agreement and you go on. So, you know, those guys, you know, like I said, work extremely hard and they travel and they're away from their families. So I think it's important for them to be involved.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm not sure people realize, again, what you just said, Bob. I mean, 200 nights a year, what goes into scouting in the NFL and sort of some of the personal sacrifices that are made to in order to do that. Did you find that you, when you were a general manager in Detroit, that you had a greater appreciation for that, having done it yourself?
Sure. Yeah. You know, obviously, you know, my background, I've done a little bit of everything during my career in terms of personnel and scouting. But I think, you know, having been on the road, I was never an area scout, but I did national and I was on the pro side. So the area scouts, those guys that live in different, you know, areas of the country, you know, you have a guy in Illinois who's in charge of the Midwest, or if you have a guy in, you know, Arizona who's in charge of the Southwest. I mean, those guys, you know, they're not in the facility every day with the team. They come in for training camp for a week or two. They come in for December for a week, February for a week, and then for the week, you know, leading up to the draft. So, you know, those guys are, you know, semi-removed from the organization. So I have a great deal of respect for, you know, those guys that do that. And then, you know, they try to study our team, because you always want that when you're comparing players, when you're writing reports. How does this guy compare to the guy that is playing this position currently for your team? So, you know, I always tried to dive in with those guys and make sure that, you know, they knew their voices were going to be heard.
Yeah, can you expand on what you just said about that? That's another thing I think that is interesting about the draft. People have to understand, you're not just stacking a board and comparing players to other players and players at other positions. What you just said was you are comparing the players in this draft to guys who are already on your roster. And I also want to know, do you also compare them to guys in past drafts, or maybe guys who you think will be available in the next draft, when you're trying to make this decision of where you're going to go and what players you're going to have come to your team through the draft?
Yeah, I think, you know, when scouting reports come in, you know, weekly during the season, you know, it's a document. It's there's numbers, there's words, there's a paragraph. And, you know, what we always did and what I did in Detroit was you want to paint a picture that if the head coach or the GM or the VP of personnel just reads the last four or five sentences of your report, does that paint a picture in their head if they've never seen the player? And so you really want to use player comparisons. Like, you know, it could be a comparison from a guy 4 years ago, could be last year, could be a guy on your team, could be another guy in the league. Because you want, you know, someone that hasn't watched that player on film yet to say, okay, I understand this scout thinks this guy plays like this. So that really, we want it to paint a picture of the player. And then going into your other part of the question, you know, when you're trying to figure out who to take, you really don't care about what happened last year. You care about who's on your team, where guys really stack in the position order of whatever, say linebacker. What does your linebacker room look like right now? Okay, if we draft this guy in the second round, where is he going to fit into that room? What positions is he going to play? Is he going to be a guy that has position versatility, or can you just play Mike linebacker and that's it? So that's kind of where we go. And then the hardest part is, you know, trying to predict where's the depth going to be in next year's draft. So we try to do that the best you can, because the area scouts kind of have an idea of, you know, who the top guys are, but they don't know the entire draft, obviously, for the future year. But you do try to ask them the weeks leading up to the draft, hey, you know, in your best estimation, you know, what positions are going to be heavy at the top of the draft next year? And that's probably the hardest thing. You really can't, you know, concretely say that, but you want to have a little bit of knowledge of that going into it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Just, you know, so many machinations and variables that can sort of go into it. And the fact that, again, I'm not sure people know, to your point, you're right, because look at somebody like Joe Burrow or Mac Jones, right? The year before they were in the draft, I don't think anybody would have had them where they're ultimately taken in the case of Joe Burrow, number one, or Mac Jones where they're going to go, which we assume will be in the top 15 picks or so. And so you can try and project out, but that's really challenging to do. But again, I don't think the average fan knows just how much work has been done at this point in the scouting community on the 2022 draft. It's not like I think they think that you guys wait until 2021 is done and then you just start on 2022. And that's not the case, right?
Yeah. And I would add Zach Wilson to that category as well. I mean, he was a guy that his stats for his first 2 years playing at BYU were marginal. And then he had to come in and compete for his job this year and obviously played outstanding, is going to be, you know, maybe the second overall pick. But yeah, this is a year round thing. So when our scouts are, you know, out on the road, they're watching guys that are not only draft eligible this year, but you always want to keep an eye on the juniors, because come January, the best ones are going to come out. So you always have reports on all the juniors, so that can carry over to the next year's draft. And then depending on how you have your department structured, sometimes there's some lower level scouts that are actually working on next year's draft, you know, starting in late March and April, when the information from the junior pro days are coming out. So depends how you structure everything, but there's always looking forward when you're trying to do your draft prep.
We talked about some of the quarterbacks here. I'll just name the top five guys. You know, Trevor Lawrence is the presumptive number one pick. I think we'd all be shocked if he went anywhere other than one to the Jacksonville Jaguars. And Urban Meyer, their new coach. Zach Wilson, as you mentioned, is expected to go number two to the New York Jets. Then there's some intrigue at number three. The 49ers will take a quarterback. We just don't know which one. Could be Mac Jones, could be Trey Lance, could even be Justin Fields. So now I've covered those top five guys. What is it about this class, those top five guys, that makes this class so desirable to teams? And really, I think they're on the cusp of being potentially a historic group in terms of where they go in this draft.
Yeah, I think that group of five, like you mentioned, in what I've seen, each of them have a little bit of what you want, and some of them have a lot of it. And I think, you know, for me, in the way, you know, I was raised in this business, the two most important things for a quarterback are accuracy and decision-making. Like, those two things override everything. But now I would say in the last 3 years, I think a third thing has crept into that is athleticism and ability to run, because that's a new part of what is going on in the NFL. And obviously that has leaked from college football into the National Football League over the last couple of years. And as you can see, some of the younger quarterbacks that have been taken in the first round, the last, what, say 3 years, have a very much a running component to their skill set. And I think that's something where we changed in Detroit the last 2-3 years. We kind of just, you know, made it that an additional, like, major factor in grading the players. You know, before it was, you know, you're looking for a pocket passer, you're looking for Tom Brady, you're looking for guys that are, you know, mobile in the pocket, but if you can't run, you can't run. Nowadays, I think the right thing to do is to look for a guy that has all of that, because there's many more of those guys that can run playing quarterback in college. So obviously over time, they're going to filter up.
And what does, you know, this has become a term that I've heard more recently. You know, for years, you hear some of these sort of scouting terms, and it can be anything like upside or potential or length or whatever. But with the quarterbacks, I'm hearing more and more, Bob, off-platform throws. What does that mean, and how does that equate to actual NFL games? What do you guys mean when you talk about someone's off-platform throws?
Well, I would say, like, on-platform is you take your drop or you're in shotgun, you get set, and no one is around you, and you can throw. It's like 7-on-7. There's no pass rush. Everything's perfect, which in the NFL, everything's not perfect. So, you know, off-platform throws are you're running to your right. You kind of have to quickly plant and throw, or you have to run on the move, or maybe the pressure is coming to the high side of the pocket and you have to climb up in the pocket, which means move up into the pocket 2 or 3 yards and maybe throw off balance. So it's just off platform is like just not being set. You have to be a good athlete. You have to have a loose, you know, upper body to make those throws when you're like that. And you see the young quarterbacks that have been successful in recent years. I mean, they do off platform throws, you know, 80% of the time.
Yeah, Mahomes is unbelievable at that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, those guys, and, you know, Kyler Murray and those type of guys.
Watson, Deshaun Watson's great at it.
Yeah, they all are. And you just have to be careful, because those quarterbacks that are athletic and they can run, they have to be really smart, because you don't want them taking a bunch of hits. So they got to know when to slide and when to get out of bounds, and don't fight for those extra 2 yards. You know, they just live to play another down.
In your estimation, and you've been doing this for such a long time, has it become harder or easier to evaluate these quarterbacks in terms of the connections and some of the differences between the college game and the NFL game? It feels like some of the college game is now trickled up to the NFL game, but you look at a lot of these college games, Bob, and just as a media member and a fan, I look at what the quarterback's doing, and he's constantly looking to the sideline, and they're holding up cards, and it just seems very different from a pro style of offense.
Yeah, I would say it's harder to evaluate quarterbacks now than it was, you know, say 10 or 15 years ago, just because of that. The systems, everything, a lot of them are spread, you know, not all of them. You know, Alabama has a traditional offenses. You can rattle off a handful of teams that are big schools that play more NFL style, but the great majority of them are spread, and the great majority of them don't even huddle. You know, one thing that we've added to asking quarterbacks and researching quarterbacks is, have you ever been in a huddle and had to pronounce a play? And the vast majority of those answers in the last couple of years has been no.
Wow.
Because like what you said, it's, they're holding up signs, they're doing signals, everyone's looking to the sideline, including the receivers and the offensive line. And the quarterback is just really barking out the protections, but he's never, you know, sat inside a huddle with 10 other guys and read a play, which you see the young quarterbacks, when they get to the NFL, a lot of them, and some of the older ones too, are still using the wristband, which is smart. But, you know, our quarterback in Detroit, Matthew Stafford, before they traded him, he didn't really like to use a wristband. He was really smart. He could hear it in his headset, and he could rattle it back off to his teammates. But a lot of the young guys, they really hadn't done that when they were growing up playing Pop Warner in high school into college. And so that's a brand new thing for them to learn. And that's probably one of the most important things, is to be able to communicate to your teammates what the play is and what everyone's job is.
That's fascinating. So a lot of these guys are learning that. They're not only learning it for the first time, but they're doing it at the highest and most difficult level of football.
Yeah, and the coaches expect it to be perfect. So that's why I think, you know, you see some of the young quarterbacks come in, they might struggle initially, but then their talent takes over once they get comfortable. And that's just something you have to evaluate and you have to know. And I would say, you know, the guys this year, you know, some of them can do some of those things, and some of them probably have never been in a huddle in their life.
You mentioned when you were in Detroit that you implemented sort of a scouting system similar to what was in New England. So I want to pick your brain on this as we talk about this quarterback class, and I want to extend it a little bit more. There's some second tier guys that I think people in the league like: Kellen Mond from Texas A&M, Davis Mills from Stanford, Kyle Trask from Florida. Is there anybody in your mind that sticks out to you saying, based on your Patriots experience, this is the type of guy that they would grade highly or that would be a fit for their system?
Yeah, not totally sure, since I haven't been there in 5+ years. But, you know, I would say in general, and their system has changed too. You know, once, you know, Tom left and, you know, Cam Newton was their quarterback last year, their offense was not the same. They tried to tailor it to what Cam was good at. So I'm not sure what system they have in place, to be truthful. And I think it would probably depend on who the quarterback is. But the guys you mentioned are probably the next three. And the one guy that I was always intrigued at, and we evaluated him this past year, was Mond out of Texas A&M, because I think he has a little bit of Dak Prescott in him. Similar size, similar arm, can run. But, you know, we'll see. I'm not sure exactly, you know, what they're thinking or what they might do. But I think, you know, really – any of these quarterbacks, if you get put in the right situation with a good surrounding cast, that any of these guys can be successful.
You mentioned Kellen Mond there. I'm just curious, because there's sort of this idea of Jimbo Fisher quarterbacks have not had a ton of success in the NFL, whether it's E.J. Manuel or Christian Ponder or Jameis Winston. And Jeff Tedford, when he was at Cal, was sort of the same thing. And then it was like, oops, Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
Is that something that teams take into account? Like, okay, this guy played for this coach. He coaches quarterbacks. Like, the knock on Jimbo's quarterbacks is that they're kind of deliberate, robotic. Is that something, you know, not specifically to Jimbo, but just something that you guys would take into account when you say the Tedford quarterbacks haven't been successful and they tend to do this and we got to coach it out of them? The Fisher quarterbacks tend to do this and, you know, we got to coach it out of them? Or do you just look at each guy individually?
The way we've done it is look at everybody individually. you know, the one that always has come up was Tedford. Like, that comes up in draft rooms all the time.
Okay.
You know, he's not, I don't think he's coaching anymore. In years past, he was a guy's name that always came up because of the Aaron Rodgers, obviously, burst on the scene, has been great. So I just do take everybody individually, evaluate their skills, because really those offensive has changed as well over the years. You know, I would say Jimbo Fisher's offense probably isn't the same as it was at Florida State or, you know, his previous stops. So I think you just got to, if you look into that, it probably would get really confusing.
Okay.
To really, you know, compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges.
And just sort of sticking a little bit with the Patriot theme, I'm curious how it worked with the Patriots in terms of synthesizing all the draft info with Coach Belichick, because obviously he wears many hats in the organization. And during the season, he's focused on the team, and the scouts are out, as you mentioned, on the road all the time. And you guys are preparing reports, and you're doing things, and you're the national scout at one point. So you're working with people in the organization to get everything ready. So how did you guys all get on the same page, and what was Bill's sort of involvement level leading up to that offseason with the draft, and then once you guys were in the offseason focused on the draft?
Yeah, I think, you know, Bill does an outstanding job of he's in tune with the draft 12 months a year, just like he was a member of the scouting department. And, you know, there would be times if you're on the practice field in June during an OTA, he might come over and ask you about a question about next year's, you know, corner class or whatever. And there would be situations in October or November when you come off the road for 3 or 4 days and you're in the office and you run into him somewhere, and, you know, he'll start picking your brain about, hey, who did you go see this week? So that's just, you know, how he does it. He loves the draft, and he thinks about it and wants as much information as he can get. It's not just February through April for him. This is a, you know, year long, 12 month long evaluation process that obviously ramps up in February.
Yeah.
But it's not like he is not learning the names for the first time in February. He's probably watched the top 100 guys or so, you know, throughout the NFL season as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that, Bob. And that's, it almost sounds like I've had guys who've worked there before sort of tell me that you had to be on your toes, because he would sort of just ask you out of the blue about some player.
Absolutely. That happened all the time. So you always got to be ready.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you always have to be ready, obviously, with Coach Belichick. And I want to go back to something here that, you know, Robert Kraft said, and he mentioned this about the draft. He said, you know, in the end, if you want to have a good, consistent winning football team, you can't do it through free agency. You have to do it through the draft, because that's when you're able to get people of great talent. And then he mentions Willie McGinnis and Tom Brady. And he said, really, the teams who draft well are the ones who will be consistently good. Then he said, I don't feel like we, the Patriots, have done the greatest job the last few years. And I really hope and believe I've seen a different approach this year. What was the approach when you were there with the draft with Coach Belichick? You know, was it collaborative? Because I think there's sort of this idea that he would maybe take the reports and then look at them and then ultimately just sort of say, well, I feel this, you know, and that's ultimately what they ended up doing. But was it maybe a more collaborative process than people on the outside realize?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was definitely collaborative. And obviously, you know, when I first worked there, I worked under Scott, and he was great at, you know, keep giving everybody involved in the process. And then when Nick took over, you know, he was the same. So it's always been, you know, all hands on deck, and everyone has an opinion. And, you know, we have the various sets of meetings that, you know, most other teams have. And, you know, always felt like your voice was being heard. So, yeah, it was always very collaborative.
Yeah, so if that's good to know, because I think when Robert Kraft made those comments, people were sort of looking, well, what would possibly change? And like, oh, well, maybe Bill's going to listen to the scouts more. But in my understanding always was that, like what you just said, that, you know, he listened to scouts and other people. You mentioned Nick Caserio, Scott Pioli. You know, he would listen to those folks, now Dave Ziegler. And you take all that information in and you have to make a decision. Did you have a greater appreciation for Bill having to sift through all that information and those opinions when you were a GM, and ultimately that final decision is yours? It's collaborative, but you're the one that has to sort of take all that information and shape it into the organization's direction.
Absolutely. Because, you know, there is an enormous amount of information. Whether it's not just, you know, two scouts writing a report and you read them and you make a call. You have 10 to 15 scouting reports. You have maybe two coaches watching them. You have 5 or 6 members of the scouting department watching them. You have the medical information. How does that factor in? How does the psychological profile look? So it's not just, you know, one piece of paper for each player and you study it and you make a decision. There's reams and reams of documents, and obviously it's all digital now, but there's a lot of information that has to be sorted out before you make that final call. So yes, I have a great appreciation for it because it's not easy and you have to really evaluate all of it, because it's all important in the end for the guy to come in and succeed.
And what are you hearing from your friends, colleagues, people you know in the league in terms of this year? Because you mentioned something that is really important, the medical information. And obviously that's different this year because there's no combine. There was the 150 prospects who were medically checked in Indianapolis, but before you could have guys come into your building, you could do other things. What are you hearing from people in the league about sort of this quote-unquote, you know, pandemic draft, where the amount of information and the way the information is obtained is different from how it's usually done?
Yeah, I think it's been drastically different. You know, even going back to during the regular season, you know, scouts weren't allowed on campus to watch practice. And that's what scouts do, is they go to practice and they're on campus. They're talking to the coaches and they're talking to sources. So that's a huge thing. And then, you know, at least last year in my last draft in 2020, we had a combine, which we had all the full medical information on close to 400 prospects. You know, people loved watching the 40-yard dash at the combine. But if you ask NFL people, the biggest thing is the medical, because you get your doctors and your trainers to get their hands on basically the top 350 players in the draft. And like you, and another thing that, you know, we used quite frequently is when we had college prospects visit our facility, and you could do 30 of those, they called the top 30 visits. And, you know, we would do like a 6-hour job interview with those players. And, you know, last year and obviously this year, that's all over Zoom. So that's a big change. And I would just say, from my perspective and the people that I know and talk to in the league, there's just not as much information this year on the players compared to years past.
I'm going to bring Ellen Fleming, the producer, in here. She has a question for you that I think is really interesting, given sort of the generational difference now in some NFL players.
Before, you know, we started recording this podcast, I tried to find your social media. And am I wrong in that you don't have any?
Yeah, not a big social media guy.
So how does social media play into this? I mean, obviously medical is number one, but social media must change the game when it comes to these players. How deep do you dive into their social media, and does that really change anyone's opinion?
Yeah, I mean, we dove into their social media pretty hard. So we would have, you know, members of the scouting staff, and it's not the guys that are on the road, but more of the guys that work in the office. And you know, they would not scrub their Instagram and Twitters, but they would scroll through them. And I know there's outside companies that actually do that for some teams now. I've never been involved in that myself, but I know I've been pitched on that they would go through basically everything and flag anything that was maybe controversial or something they think you would look at. So I don't think I ever disqualified somebody by something. And I think the other thing to really understand here is, once you become an NFL prospect in your junior year in college, either an agent or a coach or someone at the school, they watch that stuff too. And they're telling these kids, hey, like, just so you know, the NFL looks at that stuff. So it has changed. I think we probably started doing that maybe 6 or 7 years ago when Twitter really started to boom.
Right. That sounds about right. Twitter's usually the social media platform that gets most people in trouble. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting, Bob. That's a fascinating question she had. And that's, I didn't realize it went back 6 or 7 years, or that there were companies now offering NFL teams that sort of service. Are the people offering that, are they football people, or are they like people that do background checks for the government or something?
They just do like background checks. It's like a background check company. I got pitched on it a couple of years ago.
Wow.
We had people that did it in-house that I thought was fine. So you better clean up that your Twitter handle, Chris.
Oh, man. I know. I better, Bob. Yeah, I got to go back. I'll tell you just a quick side story. So when I signed up for Twitter, I think it was 2008. The only reason I signed up for it, Bob, was because that year the Patriots, the team, said that they were going to be announcing their picks via Twitter. I never heard of Twitter before that, but I was still on the beat. And I was like, well, I better do this because the team's putting information on Twitter. So that was the whole reason I signed up for Twitter, because I'm not Mr. Social Media either. Ellen will tell you that. She makes fun of me. But that's the only reason I did it, because I had to do it for work. A couple more here and we'll let you go. I just want to ask you this, because you and I talked about this sort of off air and I found it fascinating. Can you explain to folks out there, there's so much talk right now about teams trading up or down. We don't know if the Patriots will do it. some people are saying the Patriots want to go in the top 10. Other people are saying they're going to trade back. But can you just explain the calculus of trading up and down in an NFL draft and how it relates to a particular player that you might like?
Yeah, first off, like all those conversations start like early this week or late last week. You call around to your colleagues and say, hey, would you have interest moving up, moving down? So you can kind of categorize them on when the draft comes around. Like, I know these, you know, six teams were willing to move down, and I know these 12 teams were willing to move up. So you kind of have that, you know, predetermined list that you're going through. But I would say the hardest thing about doing a trade is you need two teams. People, I would say fans in general, just think, why didn't you trade up? Or why didn't you trade down? Well, sometimes you need a partner to do that. So, and sometimes you have a partner and you can't figure out the compensation, but that's a rarity because, you know, generally speaking, most of the trades, you know, are the compensation is, you know, you figure it out. You look at your trade value charts, and I'm sure your colleague has one that's very similar, if not the same, and you try to figure out something that's fair. You know, I would say the San Francisco trade might have throwing that off a little bit because they, you know, they paid a premium to get up to number three.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to see if any of those teams, you know, from 10 to 17 want to get up in the top 10, what they're going to have to pay because, you know, I think San Francisco might change the price.
That's really interesting. And speaking of San Francisco, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo is somebody who was a big pick for the Patriots and then obviously had some success with the 49ers. How would you evaluate him at this point in his career? And is it hard to evaluate him with the injury stuff?
Yeah, I think as when healthy, he's obviously, I mean, he took his helped take his team to a Super Bowl a couple of years ago. So when health is good for Jimmy, he's an outstanding quarterback. He's a starting level quarterback in the league. It's you know, availability is more important. So you have to be out there, especially at that position. It really depends on where he is health-wise. And, you know, Jimmy's a good player. I was there when we picked him. And, I think he has a great skill set. It's just, you know, you got to be out there.
You mentioned you were there when you picked him. I mean, did you, again, anytime you make a pick, you think the guy's going to be successful. But did you guys know with Jimmy that he would be, again, when healthy, a Super Bowl caliber quarterback? What was it? Because I remember Jimmy was not on my radar that draft. And I'm a big college football fan, which is different from being a scout, but obviously I cover the team as well. And I was kind of like, who's this Garoppolo guy they're picking in the second round?
Yeah, obviously I think, you know, the coaching staff and the scouting staff came together on that one. And I think everybody was kind of, you know, excited about that player at that time. Now, to say he was going to be, you know, a Super Bowl worthy quarterback, I'm not sure that we said that. We just liked the skill set. You know, he really liked the kid. He was really smart. You know, he was a strong built kid. He's got a strong arm. He's a good athlete. There was a lot of positives. I remember we had him in for one of those 30 visits and he came away with, you know, being very, very impressed with him as a person too, which is kind of like the last check mark. Especially for a smaller school guy that, you know, didn't play against top competition. You just got to make sure that guys like that, you know, when they're coming into the NFL from a lower level school, it's not going to be too big for them. I would say it was very obvious during the time that we, you know, researched Jimmy and he came into the building that it wasn't going to be too big for him. He had, you know, really calm presence and, you know, this isn't too much for me.
Yeah, I just have a quick Jimmy story sort of for you. I remember I was interviewing him before, I think, Super Bowl 51, and he was talking about, you know, playing scout team quarterback, and he had done that before Super Bowl 49. He had played Russell Wilson. And so that's how I came up with the idea. And I was just talking to him about it. And I said, you know, how do you like doing it? He said, oh, it's fun. You get to, you know, learn these different quarterbacks. And I watch their tape and I try and pick up something that can maybe help my game as well as give the defense a good look. I said, Jimmy, who's your favorite quarterback to imitate on the scout team? And without hesitation, Bob, he said, Aaron Rodgers. I feel like there's a lot of similarities there. So that's a confident guy.
Never lack confidence.
Nope. Last question for you. We're talking about these quarterbacks. I want to ask you this. Why does it seem, and you reference this with the 49ers, why does it seem like the price for quarterbacks in the league, both moving up in the draft or just trading to get one, whether it's your old quarterback Matthew Stafford or Carson Wentz, who went from Philly to Indy, or Sam Darnold, who went from the Jets to the Carolina Panthers, the latter two guys really didn't have great seasons, but why does it seem like the price is so much higher at that position relative to other positions?
I just think there's more urgency to win now. I think just – you know, teams are like, well, my guy either is not good enough or he left or whatever. And whatever the cost is to go up and get a guy of that caliber, teams are more willing to do it. I think there's just more there's more people in head coach positions and GM positions now that are just like, hey, we can't win without this position. So whatever the cost is, we'll pay it, because the alternative is not having a guy good enough to maybe take us to the playoffs. So I think just the urgency level to win, and you know, people aren't getting a long rope nowadays to turn around programs. So, you know, if you don't have that position, you don't have a chance. I think that's always been, you know, something that's been a staple. If you don't have a quarterback, you don't have a chance. And credit to those guys that have the urgency, I would say, and to go out there and make a trade and put themselves in a position to take one of these five guys that, you know, everyone's talking about. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, no question, Bob. And I know Bob is a Norwood native, so I know you know how it works with Massachusetts real estate. I've been comparing it to the real estate market here, Bob. I'm looking for a house unsuccessfully. The price is the price, and it doesn't sound like it's a good price for you, and normally it's not. But ultimately, you have to decide, do you want the house or not? Because the price is the price.
Yeah, if the price is the price, and you know, they might get a better offer tomorrow night, so you better take it while you can get it.
Yes. Last thing for you here would be, what are you going to be doing on Thursday night? You mentioned this will be the first time since, what, 1999 that you won't be working on a draft night? So what are you going to be doing?
I'll probably watch. I'm sure my kids will want to watch and see who everyone's taking. We're still obviously big football fans, so I'll be tuning in on TV and be interested to see what happens.
Well, that sounds great. You know, Bob Quinn, longtime NFL personnel executive, former general manager of the Detroit Lions, obviously in the Patriots organization for a long time. Four Super Bowl rings, Bob?
Yes, four.
Four Super Bowl rings for Bob. So he takes us inside the NFL draft room. Nobody better to do it than Bob. And I know some smart NFL team is going to snatch you up soon, Bob.
Yep, hopefully that happens pretty soon. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.